This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
So before we start tonight's Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Sciences lecture on the future stewards of our planet, it gives me enormous pleasure to introduce the director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Tony Haymet.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. Tonight is our annual event to honor fellowship donors. We also honor SOS members and regular attendees of our Perspectives lectures. So it's great to have you all here, and I hope you all get to meet each other. I hope it's an opportunity for you to get to meet the students that you've been supporting and to talk about opportunities to support yet more students. So let me introduce our three speakers today. The first speaker is Jeff Dingler. The title of his project is Using Sonar to Assess Geohazards on Faults That Lie Beneath Oceans and Lakes. He was actually an undergrad here in 1995, and he had the wisdom to stay on here and do a master's and PhD with Steve Constable. And he works on geological and physical processes of Lake Tahoe region, the Santa Barbara Basin, and the Salton Sea Trough. You know, it took me a while to figure out when I became director why I was signing all these travel forms to go to Lake Tahoe. I thought some of our professors were more than usually creative. But it turns out not to be vacation plans, but for reasons that I think Jeff might go into. Are you going to talk about that? Good. During his time here at UCSD, Jeff has also served in a San Diego Army Reserve unit, both as an enlisted soldier and an officer. He was deployed to Iraq in 2003 and graduated from Engineering Officer School in 2006. In October, Jeff and his wife, Allison, also an SIO graduate student, will take all the UCSD and San Diego experience to Houston, where they will start careers with BP. Thank you, Jeff, for doing this talk. The second speaker tonight is Melissa Headley. Melissa is investigating ice age climate and ocean temperature using krypton, the element krypton in ice cores. Melissa completed her undergraduate degree in 2001 at Northwestern University, and as if that wasn't cold enough, she decided to study ice age climate by coming to La Jolla. Since then, she's been a graduate student here, working with her advisor, the famous Jeff Severinghaus. She studies noble gases in ice cores in order to reconstruct the past ocean temperature. And our final speaker tonight will be Mara Hart, who studies human impacts on Caribbean coral reefs. Mara, just last week, I think, defended her thesis, I'm glad to say successfully. I'm not sure what we were going to do if that didn't work out. Congratulations, Mara. And she's going to focusing on human impacts on Caribbean coral reefs. People ask you, me, why, Professor Haymet, do you study Antarctic fish when you could study Great Barrier Reef fish? And I never could figure out the answer to that, so... Mara obviously has figured out the correct project. Her current interests focus on the effect of human activities on nearshore marine ecosystems, in particular coral reefs, something that's particularly important to increasing importance in our world. And her advisors are Jeremy Jackson and Enrique Sala. She's an associate of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation here at Scripps. Her background is in the history of science, which she studied at Harvard University. And she also studied evolution, ecology, and marine conservation. She was born in Bermuda and grew up in Connecticut. And I'm pleased to say she's going to be staying around for at least a few more months. So with those introductions, let me introduce our first speaker, Jeff Dingler. Jeff.
Well, as you all know, I'm going to be talking about active faulting in Lake Tahoe today. And my most recent grad student, the last year of my grad student research, has been funded by the EV Memorial Fellowship. So probably the first question you're asking is, you know, why do we study Lake Tahoe? Why do we choose to study Lake Tahoe? There's the obvious right here, skiing, you know, preparing to ski down Mount Tulac, looking out over the kind of cobalt blue waters. But What we're really interested in is what lies below Lake Tahoe. There's actually three active faults. And in California, most people think of the San Andreas Fault in terms of all the fault activity. And this is a map from the state of California showing all the faults or all the earthquakes over the last 250 years that were magnitude 5.5 or larger. And the San Andreas Fault pretty much runs right through here, LA, San Francisco. But if you look, there's a number of faults or earthquakes, that run up the backside of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, and Lake Tahoe is right here. And there's actually a large cluster of earthquakes there. And if you look at the map on the right, here's the three faults that I mentioned. There's the West Tahoe Fault, State Line, North Tahoe Fault, and the Incline Village Fault. All three are active faults. But what we also have in Lake Tahoe that actually makes this more a more interesting scientific study is that, as we know from the Boxing Day earthquake 2 years ago, when you have earthquakes that occur in water, they can create tsunamis. And Lake Tahoe is the second deepest lake in the U.S. and the ninth deepest freshwater lake in the world. And so when you have a large fault or a large earthquake that occurs in the lake, you can have anywhere from a 3 to a 10-meter tsunami wave. And because Lake Tahoe is shaped like a bathtub, if you've ever dropped like your rubber ducky in the bathtub, you notice that the waves kind of bounce around. And so this next slide is some work that was done at the University of Nevada, Reno, but they modeled the potential for these tsunami waves, what would happen. And their research shows 3 to 10 meter waves, depending on where you are in Lake Tahoe and depending on the size of the earthquake. And so what we're trying to look at is how often these earthquakes occur and how large they are. I mean, are they dangerous? Or is there something that we have to worry about in our lifetime? And so before we actually jump into that, I should probably mention why there are faults or active faults in Lake Tahoe. I mentioned the San Andreas Fault right here. I should also mention that this kind of map view is rotated compared to what you're normally looking at. And in this case here, all the motion between the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate is in a north-south direction. So the Pacific Plate is moving this direction compared to the North American Plate. But not all the motion occurs on the San Andreas Fault right here. About 25% of the plate motion is actually transferred up the backside of the Sierra Nevadas. And there's a number of large faults on the back of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And then here is Lake Tahoe here. And this whole region is called the Walker Lane Belt. So now we'll talk about how we actually study these faults in Lake Tahoe. And Scripps is an oceanographic institution, so we're taking techniques that we've used offshore and we're applying them kind of in a lake environment, but we're also doing onshore research and tying the two together. And the research that we're conducting here in Lake Tahoe can be applied other places, like onshore and offshore in San Diego Bay, or looking at the San Andreas Fault in the where it goes into the Salton Sea. So there's three ways that we do this. One is with seismic imaging and an instrument we have called the CHIRP. And with that instrument, we can look at offset across individual faults and also get a very detailed picture of the sediment below the lake. An onshore method we have is paleoseismic trenching. It's pretty simple. You just dig a trench across the fault and look at the fault. And then finally, we can look at the bathymetry. We look at the bottom of the lake and look for different features that have been offset by faulting. So now I'll talk a little bit about all three of those. Okay, so the first one I mentioned is seismic imaging. And our instrument is called CHIRP, or it's a CHIRP, which stands for Compressed High Intensity Radar Pulse. And the technology behind our instrument comes out of radar research done after World War II at Bell Labs. Well, our instrument doesn't actually use radar, it uses sound. So it's a sonar, but it uses the same similar ideas to that original radar research. And so if you were watching in the bottom right, there was a little kind of cartoon movie going. And our instrument is towed behind a research vessel, and it sends a sound wave down. As that sound wave goes down, it penetrates the lake floor. And anytime that there is like a change in the sediment, a density change, a rock change in rock type, part of the energy is reflected back and part travels down to the next layer. And then that energy, part of that energy is reflected back. And then using the computer, we can recreate all the different sediment layers. And so we can look at the top about 75 meters of sediment in very high detail, down to about 30 centimeter resolution. Then the next method I mentioned is paleoseismic trenching. And this one is very straightforward. Take a backhoe, and you literally dig a trench right across the fault, which we did in northern part of Lake Tahoe in Incline Village. Here's our trench. It's about 8.5 meters deep. This right here is the fault scarp. And here's my advisor, Graham Kent, for scale. And so we're looking. And then, believe it or not, you actually go down in this trench and look at things. And we actually, you're hard to see, but we actually have shoring so it won't collapse, so it meets OSHA standards. At least we hope. So we're looking really for two things. One, we're looking for the fault, in which case we have it here. It's a little hard to see, but on this side of the fault, it's very sandy sediment. And over here, more kind of conglomerate, like looks more like rubble. And in yellow, I've highlighted this colluvial wedge. Sounds like a big fancy term. Really, it's just like a wedge of earthquake rubble that happens. And so when you have a normal fault is where one side of the fault moves vertically relative to the other. So you have your earthquake. This side, the left side, has gone up. Now you've got this two or three meter tall fault scarp here. But the sediment right at the edge is unstable, and it falls down over the next minutes to days to months and creates this wedge of sediment, or colluvial wedge, against the fault scarp. And over time, that wedge gets buried. But when it gets buried, it gets surrounded by pieces of like charcoal from forest fires and stuff like that. And by dating that charcoal, that carbon, we can figure out when this wedge was created and when the earthquake occurred. And then by looking at the height of the wedge, we can get an idea of how large the earthquake was. And then with our CHIRP, we can do the similar thing offshore, just not digging. We're using sound to make an acoustic trench. And then finally, in Lake Tahoe, during the last glacial ice age, about 19,000 years ago, the lake level was about 10, 15 meters lower, and it cut this kind of wave-cut terrace, which I've highlighted in red here. And the three faults in Lake Tahoe are normal faults. And so every time that there's an earthquake, the east side of the fault, so the east side of Lake Tahoe, drops relative to the west side. And if you look at this cartoon, these are measurements of the depth of that 19,000-year-old surface. So on the west side, it's about 10 to 12 meters. But on the east side, it's 21 to 26 meters. So there's more than 10 meters of vertical offset across Lake Tahoe over 19,000 years. And so next we're going to look at kind of three movies. We're flying through Lake Tahoe in 3D, and we're going to look at some of these seismic CHIRP sections in the lake. And so we'll be starting from the south end of the lake and flying north. I apologize if it's a little dark. Here's Emerald Bay for reference, and everything, like the bright colors, are actually below water. So we're going to be zooming in on this section here at Rubicon Bay, and it's really difficult to see here. I, again, apologize. But we're looking at the Paleo Terrace, that flat wave-cut surface from 19,000 years ago. And so now I'm just going to zoom in on this CHIRP section, kind of more an annotated view. On the right side, we have the depth below the lake floor. And you can see this surface is extremely flat. And there's actually vertical exaggeration here. It's actually vertically exaggerated about 16 times. So if you were to take that out, this surface would be extremely flat. I mean, tenths of a degree flat. And so the reason we know that it has been truncated by wave action is because these dipping layers here, layers don't form vertically like that. They're formed flat, and over time, they're rotated. And then the waves come and sit for 1,000, 2,000 years and just plane that surface off. Another thing we see here is a fault, but there's no offset at the surface. So we know that fault's not active anymore. It hasn't been active since at least 19,000 years ago. But just to the west, or sorry, just to the east of this, about 200 meters, is the West Tahoe Fault. And in the West Tahoe Fault, we see that on the last rupture, there was at least 1.5 meters of vertical offset. And so this cartoon is just looking at this area here. But since that time, there's been 2 meters of sediment. And so if we were to, you know, date that sediment, look at the sedimentation rate, we would find that the West Tahoe Fault hasn't ruptured in anywhere from 3,000 to 8,000 years. So next we're moving on, and we're going to look at the State Line Fault, the kind of middle fault that runs through the very bottom of the lake. And I'd like to point out the McKinney Bay. McKinney Bay wasn't always a bay. It used to be a shelf. But about 60,000 years ago, it failed catastrophically, and all that material spilled out and ran, slid all the way across Lake Tahoe, bounced off the far side, and left all those blocks that you see. Some of those blocks are almost as tall as Mount Soledad. I mean, just for kind of perspective, you could place the Empire State Building in Lake Tahoe, and the top of it would not break the surface. I mean, it's over about 500 meters deep as it's at its deepest. So now here we're looking at the State Line Fault, and I didn't point out, but you, the fault scarp was clearly visible. There was that color change from purple to pink. And so here on the State Line Fault, we can see this, all this unlayered sediment down here. That's McKinney Bay Slide. But if you go across the fault, it's offset 21 meters. And so to figure out how, when the McKinney Bay Slide occurred, we took a shallow sediment core here, and again, using carbon dating, we figured out a sedimentation rate of about 0.4 millimeters a year. And when you extend that down to the McKinney Bay Slide, you get an age of the slide of about 60,000 years. So again, 21 meters of offset over 60,000 years. That's on the order of 6 or 7 large 3-meter per earthquake events. And then so finally, for the last, we'll look at the last fault, we'll fly over to Incline Village. And Incline Village is the place that we've collected the data, CHIRP data offshore, and we've dug the trench onshore. So we zoom in, and we have a dense grid of seismic data here. And we actually have a small little ROV. It's about this big, you know, size of a couple shoeboxes. And we went down and we dove on the shallow scarp. And this is just a picture of about a 3-meter tall fault scarp just covered with boulders. And you can see that in the seismic data. All this dark material here is the boulder surface. And everything, here's the fault scarp. And then everything to the east of the fault scarp is sandy. And our trench was dug about 1,000 meters onshore. And of all places, the fault goes right through, right next to the Incline Village Elementary School. They obviously didn't know it was active when they built it. And so now we look at, here is our CHIRP data offshore. And this red box denotes where, or the size of the trench, if we were to dug that trench offshore, which we can't do, but that's where it would cover. And so on the bottom is just a simple drawing from the inside of the trench, and we can see 2 colluvial wedges in the trench. But if we look, zoom in on our CHIRP data, we can also see these colluvial wedges. And then we look at this green layer here, we see that it's offset 3.2 meters. 3.2 meters, and that is the most recent event. And by dating the colluvial wedges in this trench here, we know that that last event occurred about 575 years ago. And the event before that was thousands of years before that. So in terms of earthquake hazards, you know, the Incline Village Fault kind of has a very low probability of rupturing, whereas the West Tahoe Fault, it hasn't ruptured in, like I said, 3,000 to 8,000 years. So there's a much higher hazard on the West Tahoe Fault. So just to wrap this all up, we see that faults in Lake Tahoe are capable of large magnitude 7 or greater earthquakes. and that the rupture on during these events is 2.5 meters or more. And when that occurs in the lake, you can get a very large tsunami wave. And we also know, just from looking at all three of these faults, that these earthquakes occur every few thousand years. The most recent, on the Incline Village Fault, 575 years ago. And then the question still remains, when did the State Line Fault go? And we'd like to firm up our research on the West Tahoe, or that date on the West Tahoe Fault. And so kind of in conclusion, I'd just like to thank all of you for your support. Your support has made this Tahoe research possible, but it's also allowed me to serve in the Army Reserve during this time and to, you know, take a leave of absence for a year to serve in Iraq. So again, thank you very much. So now I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Headley.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, today I'll be talking about investigating ice age climate and ocean temperature using krypton in ice cores. So first I'll just go over, why is the ocean temperature important? Why should we bother studying it? And then I'll address a more specific research question: what was the average ocean temperature during the last ice age? And also, how do we measure average ocean temperature in the past? So I really like this cartoon. I don't know if you can read it. I'll read it for you. It says, "I don't know why I don't care about the bottom of the ocean, but I don't." So. As you probably know, or you'll see tonight, we should care about the bottom of the ocean and the entire ocean because, among other things, the ocean has a significant impact on climate. So I study past ocean temperature, and why should we study this? Well, the ocean has a very strong influence on climate. It stores vast amounts of heat, and it also is able to transport that heat. Most of the energy the Earth receives hits the tropics, and as shown in this simplified cartoon of ocean circulation, the ocean plays a major role in distributing the heat poleward. Additionally, ocean processes like changes in deep water formation may have caused climate change in the past. So it's really important to get a handle on what the ocean temperature was doing globally in the past. So now I'll go into my specific research question: what was the average ocean temperature during the last ice age? And what I'm talking about here is a global mean ocean temperature. And no one's been able to measure this before. Many scientists have measured local temperature estimates. So they'll measure a certain site using sediment cores, and they'll find out the ocean temperature at a certain site in the past, but no one yet has been able to find a mean ocean temperature. So I'll do this by using ice cores. And here are some pictures of ice cores. We have on the left an ice core being drilled, and in the middle, once the ice core is drilled, you can see what it looks like. And on the far right is the National Ice Core Lab in Denver. And once the ice cores are drilled, they're all sent to Denver, and that's where they're stored. And that's where scientists go if they want to sample part of an ice core. They go to Denver and spend a few weeks in the freezer. I've done that. Not as fun as going to Antarctica, I'm sure, but it's kind of fun. And it's actually kept at minus 35 degrees Celsius, this room, and then we work in the minus 25 degree room. So, yeah. So in our lab, we measure the air bubbles that are trapped in the ice cores. And this is a figure here that shows how these air bubbles form. When snow falls, which is the top here, eventually it becomes fern, a denser layer under the snow. And air can diffuse through both the fern and the snow. As more snow and fern pile above a certain layer, like around here, the fern becomes ice. And at that point, the air is trapped, it's hard to see, the air is trapped into bubbles. And this process continues, preserving a record of past atmosphere through time. And in this way, ice cores provide a window into the Earth's past climate. And you may have seen some records like these before. The upper left is a record of temperature from Antarctica, reconstructed using an ice core. And it's the last 450,000 years of temperature. And the way ice core records are presented is time's kind of backwards. 450,000 years ago is on the right, and the present day is on the left. So time moves from right to left. And you can see that there's short periods of very warm temperatures, and we call these interglacial periods. And we're currently in one now. And then there's longer periods of cold temperatures, and these are glacial periods or ice ages. And on the bottom right is a record from Greenland, from the GISP 2 ice core. It's also a temperature record, but this one covers less time but is more higher resolution. So we have 100,000 years ago to the present day. And this includes the last ice age, which you can see is cooler and much more variable than the present climate. The last ice age was approximately 100,000 years ago to 20,000 years ago. And the ice that I'll be talking about tonight is from around 20,000 years ago, which we call the last glacial maximum. So how do ice cores tell us about ocean temperature? It's not immediately obvious. They seem very different. But the amount of krypton in the ancient atmosphere can actually tell us about the average ocean temperature of the past. Krypton is a very soluble gas. It easily dissolves in water. And it's more soluble in colder water. So the figure here shows solubility versus temperature. And the purple curve, the second one down, is krypton. And you can see it's more soluble at colder temperatures. So how does this new ocean thermometer work? We know krypton is more soluble in colder water, and that fits in here. So these are just very basic cartoons of the present atmosphere and ocean, and also the atmosphere and ocean during the last glacial maximum. The krypton in the atmosphere and ocean together remains constant through time, as I've written here. And during the last glacial maximum, the ocean was colder. So because of krypton's high solubility in cold water, that colder ocean could hold more krypton. And that would cause a resultant decrease in the atmospheric krypton reservoir. So that decrease between the present and the last glacial maximum krypton is what I'm actually able to measure in the air bubbles in the ice cores. And the atmosphere is well mixed. So what I measure is a globally averaged atmospheric krypton decrease. And that in turn represents a globally averaged ocean temperature change. So to put it another way, if you like to see it as an equation, the krypton in the present atmosphere plus the krypton in the present ocean equals the total krypton. And we know the modern measurements, so we know the first two terms. And the krypton in the last glacial maximum ocean, I can estimate using various changes in past ocean temperature. I'll show you the model in the next slide. And then I can solve for what I would expect to see in the ice cores. So in order to understand my ice core results, I've made a model to simulate various degrees of mean ocean temperature change. And then I calculate how much a mean ocean temperature change would decrease the amount of krypton in the atmosphere. So here are the results of my model. Ocean temperature is on the x-axis here. The right is zero change, and the left is a 6 degree cooler ocean during the last glacial maximum. And on the y-axis, the vertical axis, is the change in krypton we'd see in the atmosphere. So as you can see, a colder ocean would lead to a lower amount of less krypton in the atmosphere because more of it's going into the ocean. And these results are expressed as delta krypton nitrogen, which just means that the krypton is measured as a ratio to nitrogen. And it's also in reference to today's atmosphere. So then I'll compare my model results to what I measure in the ice cores to interpret what the mean ocean temperature would be in the past. First, I'll talk about how I make my measurements before I tell you what my results were. The ice core I'll talk about today is from the GISP 2 ice core in Greenland. It's right in the center of Greenland. And the various other ice core sites in Greenland are shown here. And on the right is Antarctica. And you've probably heard of both of these sites. Most scientists get their ice cores from Greenland or Antarctica. So how do I make these measurements? Well, this is a picture of our vacuum line. What we do is we cut small pieces of ice cores and put them in a glass container, shown here, and we hook that up to our vacuum line, and we pump out all of the air from the room that was in that container, and we keep the ice cold and frozen. And once all of the ambient air is pumped out of the container, we melt the ice and let the ice melt, and then the air is released from the bubbles, and we trap that in a sample tube. And once we've gotten that air sample, we measure it on a mass spectrometer to find out how much krypton and nitrogen are present in the sample. And this is a mass spectrometer here. And very briefly, I'll tell you a little bit about how a mass spectrometer works, because this is the instrument we use to measure the gases. What we do is we expand our sample gas into the mass spectrometer where it's ionized or charged. Then it's accelerated into a magnetic field, and that magnetic field can bend the beam of gases. And it bends lighter gases more than heavier gases. So we end up separating out the different types of gases, and we can measure how much of each gas is present in our air sample. So what have we found so far? Well, using this GISP-2 ice core from Greenland, we found that the average ocean temperature during the LGM, or last glacial maximum, was about 2.7 plus or minus 0.6 degrees Celsius colder. And this actually fits in well with other local estimates of deep ocean temperature change. People have found anywhere from 2 to 4 degrees colder, and so our average ocean temperature estimate fits in very well with what other people have found at specific sites. And as I've said at the beginning of this talk, this is the first time anyone has been able to estimate a global mean ocean temperature in the past, so that's exciting in itself. But there's also potential to use this method to look at ocean temperatures through time over many glacial cycles. The most recent Antarctica ice core is almost a million years old, so we have the potential to look at what the ocean was doing for almost a million years. Ocean temperature, in addition to the way it affects krypton, can also affect other gases in a similar way, including greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. So knowing what the global ocean was doing temperature-wise can tell us, maybe help explain why CO2, carbon dioxide, varied as it did in the past. And finally, knowing how the mean ocean temperature changed through time may help to constrain models that climate scientists are using right now. So what's next? Well, we plan to measure a time series from an Antarctic ice core, the Vostok ice core, to find out how ocean temperature changed into the glacial period and out of the glacial period. And I'm also working on a new method that allows us to improve our krypton measurements and also to add a xenon measurement. So we have two independent estimates of ocean temperature change. Xenon is another gas we find in the ice cores, and it's even more sensitive to ocean temperature change than krypton. So, to conclude, this is after a long day in the freezer. Thank you very much for listening tonight, and special thanks to the Peterson Foundation and NSF for funding me through the years. And come see me after the talk if you want to see a real ice core. I've brought one up in a cooler, so hopefully it's still around. It's not a very valuable one. But. And next is Mara.
You'll excuse my frog voice. I've been doing a lot of talking, practicing my defense over the last week, and I've lost my voice a bit, so I'm sorry about that. Okay, so thank you all for coming out this evening and for all your contributions over the years. I'm going to be presenting my talk on human impacts on Caribbean coral reefs. So I'll start with the two big questions of why am I studying human impacts and why Caribbean coral reefs? And I know some of you may think you know the answers to why I'm studying coral reefs, which is that they are in beautiful, warm, tropical waters. And this definitely didn't dissuade my choice of research topics, but coral reefs exist across the globe. So why am I focusing on the Caribbean, and why am I focusing on human impacts? And the answer, unfortunately, is that coral reefs in the Caribbean are in pretty bad shape. So when we think of a healthy Caribbean reef, we envision a dominance of large, massive coral colonies. These provide the habitat that then support all of the diversity and abundance of other organisms that we think of as associated with a reef, such as large groupers and turtles, sharks, tarpon. But in reality, Caribbean reefs today look more like this. These are photographs that I've taken between the years 2004 and 2006. And what they show are that the reefs are overgrown with large fronds of fleshy macroalgae. Most of the coral skeletons are dead and covered by this algae, and the water column is largely devoid of fish. This transition from a coral-dominated to an algal-dominated system occurred relatively rapidly over about the last 30 years. And what's particularly interesting about this transition is it occurred during the time when scuba diving was making it possible for scientists to actually get in the water and study the reefs. So we have this strange paradox where scientists are studying the reef systems, but while they're studying the reef systems, the reefs are slowly degrading right beneath their noses. This raised the question of what was it that these studies were missing? And the answer is perspective. Traditionally, coral reef ecology studies have been conducted on very limited scales. So if we can think of a traditional study as being occupied by this space here in the triangle, they focused on limited groups of organisms, such as just looking at corals or just looking at fish. They were conducted on small spatial scales, often looking in a 1 meter squared plot over a small section of reef. And normally the studies only lasted for a few months, on occasion to a year, and on a very few occasions, several years. The problem with this is that reef organisms operate on much larger timescales. A grouper or shark may live to be decades old, and a single coral colony may be over a century old. So there was a disjunct between the scale of the studies and the scale at which the ecosystem itself was operating. So in the early 1990s, scientists began to expand the perspective with which they were looking at coral reef systems. They began to use non-traditional sources such as historical records and fossil records to try to get an idea for what coral reef systems used to look like over larger timescales and across larger spatial scales. What these studies showed was that reef systems from the 1950s to the present day have been studied in the absence of some of the largest players on that reef system. These studies showed that fishing by humans has been an underestimated impact on reef systems, and that more recent impacts such as pollution, disease, and global climate change are all much more relatively recent impacts compared to fishing on coral reefs. So building from these recent findings, I decided that I would look for my dissertation and try to quantify how human activities, particularly fishing, have impacted coral reef systems, but to do so by looking over expanded temporal scales and spatial scales. I used three different approaches to do this, and I'm going to summarize them now, but I'm going to focus on one this evening to present the results, because otherwise it would be a very long talk. So I used historical analysis, which involved using everything from archaeological data to pirate journals, to journals of other contemporary naturalists who went to certain islands at certain periods of time to try to reconstruct how humans had used marine resources on the island of Jamaica over the entire 1,400 years of human occupation. In this way, I was expanding the temporal scale to understand changes of human impacts on the reef. Because corals have a hard skeleton, they also have a great fossil record. So in my second approach, I used fossil records of coral reefs to compare how coral assemblages in the past compare to the reefs of today that I was studying. And using this approach, I was able to look at how the reef has changed both before and after human influence. And the third approach is what I'm going to describe in detail, and I'm calling this a space-as-time approach. And in this approach, I'm trying to understand how changes in the fish community also affect changes in the coral reef community, to look at the whole ecosystem at once. Now, to study a coral reef and see how fishing has impacted a system over time would mean my dissertation would take decades if I were to sit and actually watch this transition. So instead, we use what's called a space-as-time model. I went to several different sites in the Caribbean, both in Belize and Mexico, Florida, Cuba, and Jamaica. And in each of these sites, there's different abundances of fish. So by looking across a large area in many sites, I was able to reconstruct, or hopefully reconstruct, a gradient of change from low to high fish biomass. And by surveying the communities in these different sites, I was able to determine how different abundances of fish affect the rest of the community. And in this way, simulate through space the type of changes that may have occurred through time on coral reefs. So in each of these places, I looked at 2 to 3 different regions. And in each of these regions, I looked at 3 to 4 sites. And at least one of these sites was in a marine protected area. And the idea here is, in a marine protected area, we have no fishing allowed. And the hope was that this would provide me with certain sites that had a high abundance of fish biomass. At each of these sites, I looked at 2 different depth habitats, which are dominated and formerly dominated by different types of coral species. And the idea here was to see whether or not the changes that were affecting the reefs had different impacts on different types of reef fauna. I surveyed the reefs with my partner in crime, Gustavo, and we looked at the fish community, the benthic community, which means any organism which is associated with the bottom, so corals, algae, and sponges, as well as mobile invertebrates such as sea urchins and starfish. And just to give you a quick peek, this is the list of all of the different taxa that we looked at. So it really is a community-wide study. We have over 30 species of coral, different species of algae. These are all of the mobile invertebrates, and these are over 100 species of fish, ranging from grazing fish to top predators such as sharks and groupers. So what did we find? I'm showing 2 graphs here of the 2 depth zones, the 5-meter and the 15 meters. On the y-axis is the biomass of fish, so it's the grams of fish per area, per meter squared. And along the bottom of the axis are the different regions we went to. At 5 meters, we had a range from 14 to 260 grams per meter squared. And we had twice this range at 15 meters, from 15 grams to almost 600 grams per meter squared. This is the largest range that's ever been documented on a coral reef, including in the Pacific. And it shows that in the Caribbean, there are areas where high fish biomass is still supported by the reef, despite centuries of fishing. In addition, we found that these arrows mark the sites that were in no-take marine protected areas. And what we determined was that in those marine protected areas marked Z and C, these are the largest and oldest marine protected areas we have. And this is where we found the highest fish biomass and the highest proportion of predators. Fishing tends to target upper trophic level species. These are the really tasty snappers and groupers that we all like to eat. So when we see a decline in total fish biomass that's driven by fishing, we tend to lose the top predators at a disproportionate rate because they're the ones that are selectively removed more so than other fish species. And this is what we see here. So it's not only that there's a large gradient, but we see that that gradient is most likely caused by fishing pressure. In terms of the relationship between the fish and the rest of the benthic community, we found that the more fish there was, the less algae there was at 5 meters. And at both depths, the more herbivorous or grazing fish there were, the less algae, which is what we were hoping to find and is what is expected, given that the fish eat the algae. However, we find that there was no correlation at all between the amount of coral that was on the reef and the amount of fish, despite the large gradient that we were able to document. In addition, we found at 5 meters that the more fish there were, the less urchins. But at 15 meters, you can see here, there's hardly any urchins. They're still very rare following a disease in the 1980s, which wiped out a huge number of the population of sea urchins, and they have not yet recovered in most of our sites. So what we found was that the reefs in the Caribbean contain an enormous range in total fish biomass, and that it's larger than any that has been found so far, including between the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and the main Hawaiian Islands. We know that this gradient is driven most likely by fishing pressure. And so it's no surprise that we see in the no-take marine protected areas that are enforced and are large and are long-term, fish assemblages look to be coming towards relatively healthy fish assemblages. So they reflect similar total biomass and proportions of different groups of fish, such as herbivores and apex predators, as we see in the Pacific under reef conditions that have had much less human influence. We did find that fish reduce algal biomass, but the corals have not yet recovered. And nowhere did we find high fish biomass and high coral biomass. So why should we care? Well, first, the work shows that we need this full perspective, a larger spatial scale and a larger temporal scale, so that we can understand how much coral reefs have changed. This allows us to have a better gauge, not only of the magnitude of decline, but so that we can more accurately measure successful recovery as we work to restore some of these systems. We also show that the most effective reserves are those that have no fishing allowed whatsoever, that have been in existence for over a decade, and that are large, over 100 kilometers squared. The size of the reserve is important for two reasons. The first is that large fish tend to have larger home ranges and need more space so that they can be protected through their entire range of activity. But the second reason is that these large reserves encompass other critical habitats besides reefs, such as mangroves and seagrass bed communities. These communities serve as important nursery grounds for many of the reef fish and are likely a very important component of the recovery of the reef fish populations that we saw in some of those reserves. But an important finding was that fish alone do not seem to be enough to restore the corals. This could be because corals are very slow growing and we just simply need more time before we can see recovery in the corals. Or it could be the fact that the other main grazer on the reef, sea urchins, is still very rare in many of our sites. And without sea urchins, it could be possible that algal-dominated reefs cannot be restored to coral dominance. So this might sound like a very depressing note to end on. So instead, I'm going to convince you all why I remain an optimist, even after some of these conclusions. And the first is that despite all the impacts that are currently threatening Caribbean reef systems, we know that we have an effective management strategy in the form of no-take reserves, if they're employed on the right scale, so that we can affect the fish assemblage and reduce the algal biomass, which is a step in the right direction towards restoring coral dominance on the reefs. Other work has also shown that urchins are coming back. We're not really sure why, and we're trying to figure out how to predict what conditions are affecting this, but where they come back and where grazing is occurring, we see that certain corals are coming to dominate the reef. And other studies have shown that coral recruitment, or baby corals, are also much more abundant in these regions. And finally, despite the fact that most of the reefs I surveyed were algal-dominated, all coral species still exist on Caribbean reefs, so the potential for recovery still exists. Of course, it's very important, however, to keep perspective. And the big unknowns right now for coral reef systems or whether or not these local management efforts are going to hold up in the face of the large-scale global types of changes that are occurring, which include increased sea surface temperatures, acidification of the oceans, and the rapidly changing sea levels. And this remains to be seen. However, it's incredibly important that we restore as much resilience to the reef systems as we can. And the work with the reserves and this recent work with the sea urchin shows that we can bring back some. We can put some steps forward in terms of restoring conditions that are healthy for corals. So I will finish now with my moral of my dissertation, which is when you're faced with a complicated problem such as the decline in coral reefs, it's always best to start at the beginning. And for coral reef ecologists, we've learned that this means we must go back to the origin of human impacts and fully understand just how much we've affected these systems so that we can have a good idea not only of where we've come from, but where we want to go to. And not only do we need to begin at the beginning, but we must go until we come to the end. And while this is the end of my talk for this evening, it's very far from the end for coral reefs. So while there's a lot of challenges, I remain very optimistic in terms of the work that we can do. So thank you all for your attention. This work and my entire dissertation was a product of many people helping me both in the field and here at Scripps, but especially all of you for your funding. It makes a tremendous difference in being able to focus on research and the science rather than continuously and always struggling to write for grants. And I appreciate very much all of your support through my entire 5.5 years, give or take a few months, of my work, especially to the EW Scripps Associates who've supported me now 3 times, both my first year and my my final few semesters. So thank you again for your time.
Well, there's no way to... I'm not completely sure about that, although krypton's very heavy, so as far as I know, there would be more at the bottom. Oh, the question was, if you took a slice of the atmosphere, would there be more krypton at the bottom or the top? Basically, would it be even? But krypton is a very heavy element, so it would, as far as I know, be settling at the bottom. The question was, krypton... I think what I was saying was that krypton dissolves in the ocean and the atmosphere. And, okay. And is there any interplay?
Is it unchanged
through time? Can it leave the bubble in the ice core? Not significantly. People have measured diffusion out of air bubbles in ice cores, and if they're stored for a very long time, maybe decades, you might see some krypton loss, but you'd more likely see argon loss or oxygen loss, which are smaller molecules, actually. Krypton's big enough that it doesn't leak out of the air bubbles. It's an inert gas, and the isotope I'm measuring, the mass in particular, is a stable isotope. So there's basically, it's inert, which, oh, the question was, sorry. I said that krypton's constant through time, and how can I assume that? And the answer is that krypton is an inert gas, which means it doesn't react with anything. It basically just passes, it's kind of a physical tracer. And so, and because I'm measuring a stable isotope, there's no source of it or sink of it, so.
Was the disease that wiped out the sea urchins related to human, was it a human-caused disease event? It's an unknown pathogen. It was incredibly rapid, and even though there were scientists in the water collecting sick, visibly sick sea urchins, we never captured the virus, and within signs of disease to the death of the animal was about a 48-hour period, and it traveled from Panama up and around the entire Caribbean basin within less than a year and took out 99% of the urchins. It was incredibly virulent. But we know that other organisms which are related to sea urchins, such as starfish, they're all in this group called echinoderms, they tend to undergo boom and bust population cycles. And so it's not really known whether or not humans have influenced that. They've tried to look through the past to see whether or not there's evidence for a mass mortality or whether urchins used to be more or less abundant. But unfortunately, looking at the spines through paleo fossil data hasn't proved possible. It just doesn't seem to work. The spines don't seem to preserve very well. So the tendency is to think no, but it's very possible that we influenced either the spread or maybe the virulency, the degree of infection. But in terms of having that kind of a mass mortality, it does tend to occur in this group of organisms. It was in 1983, and there's no real direct link. It wasn't a major year for bleaching. As far as I know, nothing. And there's no real connection either. Again, because it was Caribbean-wide, it occurred in both leeward, windward sides of islands, places that had warmer and slightly cooler. It's a large enough area that they don't think it was particularly related to a factor such as that.
The question was, are there any signs of prior tsunamis on the shores of Lake Tahoe? And I would say that the research on that is inconclusive. There's some researchers that say they've found some tsunami deposits, but you have to remember that a 60,000-year-old, the tsunami from the McKinney Bay slide occurred 60,000 years ago, and that was before the Tioga glaciation and during the Tahoe glaciation. So there's two glacial periods kind of overprinting that, and glaciers tend to kind of smooth out the topography, kind of rework sediment as they move along. And they also have lots of sands and gravels and stuff like that, the same things you'd see from a tsunami deposit. So it's kind of very difficult to distinguish a tsunami deposit from a glacial deposit.
The question was, do I see correlations between different core sites as to what temperature I get? And so far, I've only measured one ice core site. And that's why in the next few months, I'm going to measure an Antarctica ice core. And if this mechanism is what I think it is, then the Antarctica ice core should tell me the exact same thing as the GIF 2 ice core. Because while krypton isn't universally mixed vertically, it should be well mixed across the surface of the Earth. So we should be getting the same signal from an Antarctic ice core as well.
So the question is, how do we work with local management bodies in the Caribbean? And is the lore of that a native fishing population will only take what it needs to take really true? One of the things that's really interesting in the Caribbean is because of European colonization, actually native fishing cultures don't exist anymore. It was pretty much mass genocide of the native populations. And nowhere, except for maybe a little bit in Haiti, are there any real evidence of continuous cultures that are still from the native people. It's slave importation to support plantation economies in most of these places, and that's what the most recent populations over the last 400 or 500 years are based on. And most of those populations did not have a history of a fishing culture. So it's not like Polynesian islands and in the South Pacific or Hawaii, where there's this long tradition. And what we see, unfortunately, is a real lack of any sort of awareness, either by the governments or by the local populations, of how to regulate the fisheries. And I am very interested in using my work, and because each of the regions we went to, we worked in marine protected areas, we are in close contact with the management bodies. And the first step is to show where their reserves sit compared to other reserve systems in the Caribbean, how they're functioning, how far along recovery they are, or whether they lack recovery, and try to work with them on size and placement of reserves to encourage more effective management. Some places are much more difficult than others in terms of the socio-political state. Again, a lot of my work focused on Jamaica, and that is a very tough battle. It's very unstable and difficult to regulate. But we are in work with places like the Yucatan in Mexico, and the governments in Belize, as well as the Florida Keys, are much more willing and eager to invest and figure out the situation. So, that's definitely the next step, is to make the work available to the bodies that need it.
Okay. I've been told that we're kind of out of time here, but the three of us will stick around. So if you have questions, come up to us afterwards.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Very good.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.